drink to see it.
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless this highly nutritious microwave more macaroni and cheese dinner that people sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories. That's a gluten. Fat. That's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Filled protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat's back on the menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and calf and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Wake up!
And welcome to an Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. And we are back after a unfortunate week off.
Yes.
And Catherine is back in studio as well. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Finals have completed.
Finals are done. Congratulations to everybody from Tufts.
Yeah, everybody's graduating. Finished finals. That was a good moment.
Yep.
For most people, field day yesterday, if you were there, was a good time.
Field day, and yeah, it's a good moment as long as you're not stressfully awaiting final grades to see if you can actually walk next a week from tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
which some people may be doing.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah. All right, so last week we were supposed to have Barbara Moran in as our guest. Unfortunately, that will have to be postponed. Hopefully, we can make that a few this week, though, with Marion Nessel. Should be in... on the phone, at least for the middle part of the show.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting. People looking forward to that.
Yeah, very exciting.
And you know what? Still going to touch on a couple of topics that I wanted to get to you last week. Before I do, the phone number here is 617-627-3800 if you'd like to call in.
Mm-hmm.
You can hit us up on Twitter at... sorry, which one are you using these
I'm
days?
I'm at Nutrition Wonk.
At Nutrition Wonk or at Boxman37. All right, so... we're going to open up with Catherine's favorite topic, which is sports.
I love sports.
Mm-hmm.
I love all of them.
Yes. And specifically, we're going to talk about, even though it's typically I hate talking about the sport and is the off season, but we're going to talk about football.
I'm really like, what's the thing that you don't like, Matt? Which thing?
That one thing. But we're going to talk about another thing I don't like, and that is Tom Brady.
Oh, man.
And it is actually very topical.
It's going to be so hard for you living in New England.
You know what? We're not going to talk about any deflated footballs, even though they did it and are guilty. We're just going to move on. We're not going to touch that.
Yeah. I can't reflect on that because I don't know. I was like, how is that against rules? I don't even know. What are the
rules? It's a long story again. We won't get into it. But yeah, you did it, as another radio host here says. So Tom Brady, this actually is very related to nutrition and very timely. You may have heard on the news that Tom Brady has, don't call it a cookbook, it's a nutrition manual coming out. Over 100 pages of nonsense, including it's like bound, like has a wooden back, front and back covers.
Oh, that's cool.
And all this. Oh, I'm sure the design's, cool. It's already sold out the first printing, so you can still pre-order, I think. Not that I'd recommend it. And you have to wait a few months, you know, be just like Tom Brady.
Are the letters like burned into the cover?
Yeah.
They really are.
Yeah. And you can take it apart and you can, they'll publish updates or whatever and you can add recipes as they come out. And
what? I'm not going to lie. That's a cool idea.
The functionality of the object itself, I will give you.
Yes. Excellent job, cookbook designers.
So here's the thing. We may touch on a little bit of this too, with Marion Nessel about some of like non-nutrition people and big famous celebrities and what they endorse and what they say about products like Coca-Cola and how that impacts people trying to get out legitimate nutrition information. But anyway, so let's get to it. So this cookbook, and it basically reiterates a lot of stuff that came out a couple of years ago when he was interviewed about his diet and all this stuff. And
yeah,
there was a whole big brouhaha. But anyway, so to recap. So first
because
of all,
his diet is very specific, is ridiculous. Right? I think I saw it a while ago, but it's sort of like one of those like elimination diets, right? Where there are a lot of things.
It's an anti-inflammation diet. So,
but so many diets say they are. So it's what kind of anti-inflammation? So,
right, exactly. Well, here's the thing. So I have to actually give credit to a couple media outlets around here, like Boston Magazine had a headline about 10 days ago that says Tom Brady's $200 cookbook is one big farce.
It's $200?
$200. That was the other thing I didn't mention.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, just some pocket change for this. So...
Whoa.
And as they call it, so Brady has taken, this is from their article, Brady has taken another step in his apparent quest to become America's health czar, offering an already sold out $200 nutrition manual in quotes on his website.
You know, okay.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, what's kind of interesting about this is I've heard of his diet, and I think it's one of those things where you can't eat a ton of different foods, and it doesn't really make a lot of logical sense.
You can't eat tomatoes, you can't eat fruit, you can't eat eggplants, mushrooms, or peppers.
Oh, this sounds like a paleo diet.
It's not paleo. It's just here's a bunch of healthy foods you shouldn't eat because...
But it's because they don't eat nightshades or whatever. It sounds like
nightshades is one of the things, yep.
Yeah, so it's not really based in reality.
What it is based on. So he was recently interviewed for GQ, which... I may be wrong about this. I believe it was GQ, could have been Esquire, another one of those magazines, where a little while ago he basically commissioned them to come to his house and take a bunch of photos of him in fancy clothes, literally running around and jumping in leaves and stuff. So
aww.
This is what you need to know about Tom Brady. He's a real cool guy. So
I think that's cool.
He
Tom.
Talks about when
he's listening.
Clearly. But I wouldn't know. So a lot of the stuff that he ascribes to is courtesy of his trainer, Alex Guerrero. Have you heard of him at all in his background? So he is, again, this is another article from, another headline from Boston Magazine, pointed out that he is a glorified snake oil salesman. This is a guy who advertised a supplement called Supreme Greens, which could supposedly cure cancer and AIDS and other diseases.
Oh, yikes.
He has tried to pass himself off as a doctor before, which he is not. He claims that he had developed a drink that could prevent concussions. So this is a guy that's informing this $200 nutrition.
Oh, wow.
Manual.
Yeah, that's sketchy.
And there's a quote where Tom Brady was telling GQ that basically he was sitting there working out and was talking to his boy Alex Guerrero, saying when he's done playing, he wants to be able to pass on all this information about how to work out, what to eat, what not to do, and all this other stuff. So it's coming from a guy who you should not be listening to at all.
Not a great source of information.
Right. In 2014, Brady did an interview with Sports Illustrated. I believe this is part from this interview, where, again, they're talking about, they start throwing out terms like alkaline and acidity and all this stuff, and just stuff that the everyday person who's dropping $200 on a nutrition manual should not really be concerned about.
Yeah.
And then some more backlash was, this was back, this was actually earlier this year. A PhD, Mike Roussel has a PhD in nutrition, and had basically a column reacting to Tom Brady's. This is before the cookbook came out. That's what I'm gonna call it.
Okay.
He was just kind of writing generally about his diet. This was back in January, and he said he was embarrassed to read about his diet. It's full of buzzwords, not science. Again, he reiterates that Brady does not eat fruit. And then he basically concludes that his diet's effective because it's low in added sugar, high in vegetables, and moderate in lean proteins, or in other words, for the reason any diet would work.
Right.
So, yeah.
Including the MyPlate, which is similar.
Exactly. Or a Mediterranean diet or something, you know, anything that doesn't restrict yourself, that doesn't cost $200 to buy. And Tom Brady, let's not forget, he's a billionaire. He's married to a billionaire.
Yeah.
His full-time job is to play football and get in shape.
Yeah.
This is what he does.
Right, right.
You're not going to get this cookbook and become Tom Brady.
Yeah, although that'd be nice. But I think the thing that's sort of interesting about this is it is misguided in a lot of ways, clearly. He doesn't have a solid source for his nutrition information, and you can imagine it's so hard because it seems, for a lot of people, it seems to make sense, but it actually isn't based in anything. But it is interesting that, like, probably one of the biggest figures in football history ever has come out with a diet, essentially a diet and nutrition book. I mean, it's so interesting because you think of football as being this, like, I mean, and I'm talking so general because I'm so outside of anything related to football, but you think of it as being like everybody's getting together and eating wings and drinking beer, and it's just an inherently unhealthy pastime that's associated with unhealthy behaviors. So it's really interesting to see, like,
it's an unhealthy sport.
Right. Well, that too. But to see a leader sort of within football who's very much, I guess you could say, like a man's man, coming out with something that's like a nutrition-based book. And the hopefully, right, the bright side of this would be that people who otherwise really wouldn't be either exposed to the idea of good nutrition or interested in it or think that it's something that fits with their sort of point of view, maybe, like, would be interested in it. I don't know. That could be like a potential good effect.
I
mean,
I think that's a silver lining that people try to point out, right, and try to stretch for every time.
Also,
something
I love
like
the idea that, like, Tom Brady ever cooked something.
Oh yeah, so like, yeah, like his favorite, and people make fun of this all the time since that Sports Illustrated article came out a couple of years ago. But so his favorite recipe from his cookbook is avocado ice cream. If you really want avocado ice cream, here's a hint. Don't drop $200. Google avocado ice cream and you'll have 15 recipes.
Well, that's the other crazy thing about cookbooks now is that you can find essentially every recipe online. A lot of times cookbooks, I mean, because I love cookbooks, but I think primarily it's they have beautiful food photography and kind of the extras in them are what
like your,
is
your
really,
wood paneling.
Yeah, the wood panel. I would definitely be like, oh, wood panel cookbook? I'm down. But yeah, you can find everything on like allrecipes.com for free. So
yeah, well, that's the thing. And like, yeah, generally it's like, oh yeah, he may get people thinking about nutrition, but if he's getting people thinking about, oh, here's reasons why I can justify not eating particular vegetables or whatever.
Right.
This nonsense about inflammation and stuff. And, right, you know, he claims that it's a step closer to achieving your so-called peak performance. But a lot of people, but again, these aren't, if you're already serious about diet and nutrition, you're probably doing something that works for you.
Right.
Average person watching football every Sunday.
Right.
Peak performance for what?
Like, I'm just confused about how he's getting enough food. I wonder, like, it's hard for me to believe that he's really following that restricted of a diet only because I imagine he needs to eat so much.
Well, no, that's the other point. Oh. It's because he's a billionaire. Like, he can.
So somebody is making him enough
food.
He
has a personal chef. That's another thing. He works for his chef to develop these recipes. Right. I'm sure he's very involved.
Does he eat, like, potatoes and things? Or what's,
I can't remember,
like,
potatoes.
Sweet potatoes or. Because I'm just wondering, like, because in my mind I'm thinking, yeah, it makes sense. Okay, he's on this very restricted diet. But I think a lot of times when people go on diets like this, the side effect is that they lower the number of calories that they're eating and they subsequently lose weight. And so people tend to say, well, I didn't hold on to all this extra weight when I was on this diet. I feel so much better. It must be the diet. When really it's, well, actually there was like a lot of stuff you couldn't eat. And now you're eating at a pretty significant calorie deficit and seemingly, quote unquote, effortlessly, you're dropping this weight. And I'm just wondering, like, how are you getting enough to eat?
Or you just keep going to Subway and just get it without tomatoes because Tom Brady told you not to.
Right, exactly. And that's the other thing is that someone's going to misinterpret it and they're going to say, it's so hard to eat a healthy diet, I'm not even going to try. Mm-hmm. That's a possible response.
And the other thing that, so again, going back to this idea of nutrition communication, like the silver lining, I remember this, I think this is kind of important that people need to call it. I know that we talked about this way back with Curtis where, you know, once a new innovation comes out, people are always looking at flaws and ways to tear it down.
Right.
So keeping that in mind, I don't think that some of these messages should just be discounted outright, but I think you need to, again, see where people are coming from.
Right.
Yeah, because I remember so there was backlash against his diet initially, and then he called into a major radio show here where he regularly is interviewed. I'm sure he's compensated for it. And he kind of justified his diet. And everyone latched onto, like, if you were on Facebook at that point, he made a comment about how things like soda and breakfast cereals are, he called them poison.
Oh, gosh.
Which, again, was great. I people from Friedman were very excited about this, and people were sending them articles and be like, look at this, Tom Brady is a spokesperson speaking out against soda and breakfast cereals, which is like, yeah, that's great. He's also a national spokesperson against tomatoes and fruit. Like,
right.
You know, you have to keep it this mind. If you have to temper, I don't know, I guess, I think there's like too much bad with him and with this phenomenon to take with the good in this case, where it's like,
right, it's the balance. It's a question of, is it more good than bad? In terms of, okay, you're promoting a lot of good things that are good, telling people to limit their soda consumption, especially to a group of people that I think probably haven't been really effectively targeted by good nutrition messages. In terms of, like, you know, the football watching public, it's like, I have no idea what these people are like. I'm like, oh, the football people. It's everyone in America, Catherine. But like, they haven't been adequately targeted. But, you know, but yeah, I agree that it, if it comes with all of these kind of less, not science-based recommendations, yeah, it's probably more bad than good.
Because
mm-hmm. People already know to limit sodas in theory. But what's the new information?
Well, it's like, what will it take? Well, then, and this is something we may be talking about in another 5 or 10 minutes about soda and that messaging and who's saying what about it, what's really influencing people.
Right.
And I mean, I will give him credit because that interview, there were some unhappy sponsors after that interview when he said that. Because, again, I don't remember the full details, but, you know, there's a lot of advertising dollars in soda and other companies.
In football,
yeah, in the NFL. But
so is there any reason, like, did they state any reason why the cookbook would be $200? Like, what's the added value of this cookbook?
I think it's just A, because it can, because capitalism, B, because it's all fancy with the wood paneling, and C, because it's, because it is modifiable and you can update it, and because, like, more stuff will be
so it's a binder. So it's a 3-ring binder.
Again.
I have a modifiable cookbook for you. It's a scrapbook that I made. That's pretty funny. So he's selling you a 3-ring binder, but with wood paneling.
Laser etched.
Laser etched wood paneled.
Yes.
Binder. I'm down.
That you can't even get right now.
So he has a $200 cookbook, and the value is in theory that you can modify it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested to see, like, what the market is going to be for this, and then who's going to be going kind of on this diet. It'll be just interesting to see kind of how this whole thing pans out.
You mean the market in terms of demographic or?
Yeah, in terms of who's buying this book, you know, I don't know. Although there are two, I mean, I don't know anything about these guys, but there are some guys that live in my apartment who aren't nutrition people at all. And it's funny because I've heard them, like, I think they're like coming home from the gym or something. And I've heard them saying something like talking to each other about like nutrition messaging and like in the hallway. I live in a tiny apartment. I sound like a total creep right now. I'm like, I can hear them talking about nutrition, but they're walking up the stairs and then they're talking to each other about like added sugars or whatever. And you're just like, well, it's so interesting how messages get filtered mm-hmm. down. Basically they're just saying like added sugars aren't good for you. And so I was like, well, this is really interesting just to hear kind of how people translate like the nutrition messaging that they're getting. So, I mean, yeah, who knows now if it's going to be net good or net bad, but clearly we can tell that the person who's co-writing this with Tom Brady is not particularly reputable.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what his specific role is in this cookbook. I mean, how he helped him devise it. He's this guy, Guerrero, has been Brady's health guru forever and has some pretty scary. Yeah, I mean, there's been legal action taken against him and stuff, so it's a little bit frightening. And it also just goes back to, like, with the messaging, where a couple of weeks ago I was talking about graduation coming up with one of my coworkers, and she's like, oh yeah, you can write a book one day. I'm like, maybe I could, but it probably wouldn't be a bestseller because it's actually, I wouldn't write any of the, because we were in the diet section.
So
I was like,
problematic.
We were like shelving the diet section, and she's like, oh yeah, like, she's like, really? What shouldn't I buy? I was like, any of these, like David Asprey, I think that's his name, has his bulletproof diet book. You have Lara Prepon's cookbook. You have Chrissy Teigen's book.
Her book a diet book? I think her book is a cookbook.
No, I think that they're cookbooks and things.
Which looks great.
So I think I found like Mediterranean Diet for Dummies. I was like, here, buy this one. Like, that'll be
right.
Or like, it's more reputable than anything else in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and wheat brain, whatever.
Yeah, no, those aren't as good. But anyway, the long story short is maybe don't spend
$200
on this cookbook.
Yeah. And
feel free to buy the hashtag Unbalanced Breakfast Official Cookbook. Is a 3-ring binder we are happy to provide you for mere $150.
Very much more affordable.
And you can print out your own recipes.
Gotta pay off those loans somehow, you know? So we're going to have a cookbook.
Ultimately modifiable.
All right. So, well, that was fun. I was happy to get that off my chest. So again, if you want to call in, talk about Tom Brady, yell at me for calling him a cheater or anything else like that, number here is 617-627-3800. We are going to take a song break and hopefully be back with Marion Nestle. Going to go ahead and play the new one from Radiohead. It's like a weird, if you've seen the video, it's like a weird Wicker Man thing, and Radiohead was all weird when the song came out, because they always are. But anyway, here it is. It's called Burn the Witch off their upcoming album, A Moon-Shaped Pool. You're listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO. on WMFO 91.5 FM, also streaming live on WMFO.org.
Can you see this? And this? And this? But nothing beats the moment you see that.
Cool!
That's your child's eyes opening up to a world of possibilities.
I didn't know it could do that!
Because one trip to the forest can spark a world of difference.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go, like hiking, canoeing, fishing, or camping. Or create your own adventure with family and friends, and you might just see this. Your moment's out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
It's a medical breakthrough. Doctors are prescribing something new to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't get it filled at the pharmacy. The answer is as close as your local supermarket. That's right. Research has shown that a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, beans, whole grains, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods protects against cancer and can even help survival rates. Side effects of a vegetarian diet include increased energy, lower cholesterol levels, and better overall health. And with the right recipes, a high-fiber vegetarian diet can be a delicious way to help shed those unwanted pounds. So, stock up today. For a free nutrition booklet filled with delicious cancer-fighting recipes, visit cancerproject.org or call 866-906-WELL. That's 866-906-WELL. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
Rough, but I suck it into every stitch, trying to
Welcome back to WMFO. This is an Unbalanced Breakfast.
Yes.
And you're listening to WMFO on 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard Price Tag from Slater Kinney, which was Catherine's choice.
Yeah, which sounded like a Matt choice, right?
I know. There's like alternative.
I'm growing
like
as
that.
A person.
Getting into the right genres now. We had a couple PSAs before that. We kicked off that little break, or that extended break, with Radiohead and their new single, Burn the Witch. And a couple of hiccups, but now we are ready to go.
Yes.
Now on the line, we have Marion Nessel. Good morning, Marion. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
So yes, we are very excited to have you live on air.
Yeah,
thank you very much
so
for joining
excited.
Us. And I'm going to throw it over to Catherine.
So most of our listeners at Friedmanites are very familiar with Marion Nessel and her body of work. But for anybody else who's listening in, she's the Paulette Goddard Professor at the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. And then she's had a number of positions throughout policy. She has her PhD in molecular biology. And she also... wrote the book Food Politics, which I think a lot of us have read for, you know, undergrad or graduate classes, and recently this fall came out with a book, and has written numerous books, has the blog Food Politics, and has recently come out with the book Soda Politics, which is going to be a little bit of what we're talking about today. So how are you doing today, Marion?
Very well, thank you.
So we just wanted to talk with you about a couple different things, one of which is, of course, your book, which we read and enjoyed. But the first one is something that we've covered on our radio show before, which was the story that came out recently about Disney wanting to pull a scientific study before it was published in a journal. And so if our listeners remember, Disney had funded a study that was done on food choices, kids' food choices in the Disney theme parks, to see if replacing the foods, the sort of unhealthy side options, with healthy side options would change the way that parents and children ordered the food. But Disney, before the study was released, Disney asked that the study not be released. And initially, at least Stat News reported that that was because Disney was concerned about the association with the lead researcher on that study, who had been part of the Global Energy Balance Network, which, as many of us know, had been funded by Coca-Cola and so had been sort of dismantled because it was thought that that was a scientific organization that was primarily funded in order to find scientific findings that would benefit the soda companies. But Marion, you wrote a letter into the journal, isn't that correct?
This is one of those great moments in publishing that you wish had never happened.
Really?
The editor of the journal asked me to write a commentary on the Disney paper,
mm-hmm.
and I did so. And commented on the fact that this was a typical industry-funded study that produced results that were favorable to the sponsor's interest, and that there were real problems with the study because Disney had not permitted the authors to discuss proprietary information about baseline data and other kinds of data that would allow you to know whether there was any real change in what kids were eating in these meals at Disney. And the editors chose not to publish
mm-hmm.
my commentary with the... it was even worse than that, because then they gave the commentary to the authors to allow them to respond,
mm-hmm.
and then I had another response, and all of that was supposed to be published side by side with the paper,
mm-hmm.
but they left all of that out in the actual publication,
right.
And the editor, Brian Wansing, in his first comment to me, said, well, Disney had held up its review of the paper for so long that by the time it all came about, there wasn't any room to publish this.
Mm.
I have no idea. I said, are you telling me that Disney saw my commentary and had input into my commentary? And he said, no, that wasn't true. They had just run out of room. I don't know what happened.
Right.
But the correspondence is going to be published in the next issue of the journal in June, I'm told.
And the problem, I guess, is that if Disney can't release the baseline data, then no one is able to sort of rerun those analyses and make sure that they were correct in the future.
Yeah, it's not possible to repeat it.
Right.
And the authors who were heavily involved in the Global Energy Balance Network fiasco are, as far as I can tell, completely unrepentant about their participation in that. Mm-hmm. And they, in their rebuttal to my commentary, they argued that industry funding of research is fine and doesn't influence outcome. And we have a disagreement on that point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question, I think the question that they were asking is if they make healthier choices, the default choices within the Disney parks, does it substantially change the number of calories and the amount of fat, for example, that children are consuming?
How would you know that if you didn't know what else the kids were eating during the day?
Right, right. You mean at the park or just in general?
Or anywhere.
Right.
Anywhere.
Right.
I mean, this is one meal in a child's diet, mm-hmm. and I'm greatly for health, you know, in favor of healthier defaults.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really, really good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But to prove that it does any good, you don't even know how many meals were chosen,
right,
or whether the change had any influence on the number of meals that were consumed, because that's proprietary information. And the authors told me that they had seen that information, but that they were not permitted to use it.
Right. And that's a really good point, because before you can say, make a policy that that restaurants need to have those healthy defaults, you need to, you know, you want to prove that it works and that it's going to be effective, but you need to do it in a way where it's very clear, like, what was the baseline data, what was the change from beginning to end, and if you can't do that, then what is the study serving other than the interests of, you know, Disney to say, look, we've made this change? But what's problematic is that you actually, not only can you not really show that that's the change that was made, but, you know, you can't show whether or not it's effective outside of that. And so then it makes it less applicable.
Absolutely. So that's why it read to me like a typical industry-funded study, and it was clear from all of the discussion and the emails that later came out that Disney was just totally involved in the development, the conduct, and the results of this study. Mm-hmm. And I think that's inappropriate.
And I think I know that, and that's sort of how Stat reported on it, was that Disney as a company wasn't as used to sort of the normal constructs that are set up between, say, a company and a university when a study is sponsored to show, you know, no matter what the results are, they get to publish, you get to publish what you found. And I think the reporting that I saw seemed to suggest that Disney, because they don't typically do this type of research or haven't done this research in the past, was not fully aware of that, I guess.
Well, let's say Disney was innocent of this, but the investigators were not.
Mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
investigators have done science for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and they know how science is supposed to be done, and you don't let your funder tell you how to conduct a study.
Right, and ties into your book, Soda Politics, and also the Global Energy Balance Network, where Anahad O'Connor at the New York Times had that sort of amazing piece last year in 2015 where, you know, it was revealed that the major funder for this, the Global Energy Balance Network, was a soda company. And so, you know, problematically, that's going to influence, it might not influence, right, the methodology of the study or how well the study's conducted, but it's certainly going to influence the hypothesis or the research question, which is problematic because, of course, you know, we know, and I know that you state in the beginning of your book, if you have a 7-ounce soda, that's not, you know, every once in a while, that's not what the problem is, right? The problem is when people are over-consuming sodas like we see in the U.S. and in other developed countries. And so we just wanted to talk a little bit about the book. So do you want to just give it a brief introduction?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's an extension of the work that I've done over the last 10 or 15 years. And what I wanted to do was to write a book about food advocacy because I'm teaching food politics, policy, and food advocacy it's clear that there's a book needed that explains to people how you go about doing advocacy. In a sense, Soda Politics is an advocacy manual using soda as an example. And I titled the book Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning, because soda sales are way down. The soda industry thinks that sales are down because of health advocacy. I'm certainly not going to disagree with them on that. I think the health advocates have done a phenomenal job of making it clear that large amounts of sugary drinks are really bad for your health. Small amounts, fine. Large amounts, no.
Right.
And the and I thought it was time to do a book about the soda industry, which has been vastly written about. I mean, they're just extraordinary industries. So, I mean, when we're talking about Coca-Cola and PepsiCo because they're the major players in it. And they're just involved in every aspect of the political scene. They do everything they possibly can to create a food environment that allows, that enables people to drink sodas that have, that, that make people think that you can substitute sugary beverages for water, and have completely ingrained sugary beverages into our food culture. And that's astonishing to talk about. And then the way that they protect their sales by lobbying, by donations to organizations. The Global Energy Balance Network came out after the book was in press, but I thought the book was very, very nice preparation for understanding how that could happen.
Right.
And my experience, when that article came out, I probably talked to about 30 reporters in the week after it came out.
Wow.
And I can tell you, they were shocked. They were absolutely shocked. If they had read my book, which they couldn't have because it hadn't come out yet, they wouldn't have been so shocked.
Yeah, I mean, you don't think about
that. Because it's all there.
Right.
You don't think about it. But people were astounded in, to read that article. They had no idea that soda companies would fund research like that, that investigators would accept funding from Coca-Cola, and that universities would allow faculty to take money from food companies that way, which I think shows you how little reporters understand about how universities work, but that's a separate issue.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, though, if it kind of takes advantage of a couple different things, one of which is that, yeah, reporters maybe don't understand how a lot of science is funded, but also that there's an inherent disconnect between scientific studies and the findings in scientific studies and then the way that those studies are reported in the media. So, because I know that, for instance, obviously at our school, people do have research partially or fully funded by particular food interests, and that's something where there's a very specific, there's a hypothesis that for whatever reason isn't of interest to, say, the NIH, and so it's funded by someone who's interested in, well, you know, what happened, you know, are almonds good for X, Y, and Z, and if the, you know, if the methodology is solid, then you're finding a valid research result. The problem is, of course, that the research question can sometimes is very much is usually right in favor of any particular funder. So the problem is that you're not then looking at, but is it bad for this or is it bad for that? And so it kind of can create an imbalance. And then that gets further sort of distorted when it's reported, right? That like, oh, you can have this number of calories from added sugars a day and it's fine type of thing.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. There's an enormous amount of research. This is going to be the topic of my next book. But there's an enormous amount of research in the, let's say, medical drug and medical device industries that demonstrates that gifts from companies influence the outcome of research and practice. And there and that the recipients of the donations are unaware of the influence that those donations have on what they're doing. So you're dealing with something that's completely obscure. People don't recognize it. And if you talk to people who receive money from industry, they get furious And any suggestion, they just go ballistic, and any suggestion that that funding might influence the way they're designing, conducting, or interpreting the research.
Mm-hmm.
But the research on industry funding indicates without question
mm-hmm.
that the funding influences the research question, not the way it's conducted. Not that always seems to be, or that often seems to be done just fine,
mm-hmm.
but it influences the way the research question is developed and also the interpretation of the results. So there's a positive spin put on the results, even when the results are negative
right.
or neutral.
Right.
And there's just so much research that shows that in other fields. And to think that food and nutrition research is different from that, I think is remains to be determined. But the early signs of research on nutrition and food research is that it's just like all the others.
Right. And I wonder, too, if sort of the general effect size of a nutrition study has any sort of effect on that. Because, like you said, you know, you put a positive spin on it, and a lot of that has to do with publication bias, where it's really so important to have some significant result
right.
in order to get attention to the study. But I think what I'd love to chat a little bit about sort of some of the major themes around what you were talking about before with the major soda companies being able to lobby and affect policy. And so you have this really interesting breakdown in the book about the history of EBT and the SNAP program and how initially soda wasn't going to be included, right? And as something you could buy with SNAP dollars. I was recently at a conference and someone from CSPI was there and he was talking about how getting, sodas taken off of something that's you can buy with food stamps was a sort of a major issue for them. Now, I had always been of the opinion that, you know, if you have food stamps, that's your, you know, it's like within your decision, right? Like that's your money to buy groceries and you should be able to do that. But then you brought up this really interesting point in the book that was not always the intention of food stamps and that initially you were not going to be able to have soda on food stamps. Is that correct? Am I getting that correct?
Yes, and it didn't last very long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a congressional hearing about it, and Congress said, no, we're going to include it under enormous lobbying from the soda industry. I mean, in looking at the history of Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, they're very proud of the lobbying that they've done over the decades. And whenever anything came up that was likely to have an effect on sales, they were in there, you know, they were right in Congress. I counted up the number of lobbyists that are registered for Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and American Beverage Association, and they have 97 lobbyists in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
97!
Right.
No, I mean, any advocacy group that's trying to get something done might have one or two people lobbying, but not 97.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you look at what the soda industry is doing about the soda tax battles all over the country, they're pouring millions of dollars into fighting those efforts. So on the one hand, they want to appear as companies that are genuinely interested in public health. And on the other hand, they're fighting public health measures wherever they can. I came away from my research on the book thinking that they're schizophrenic companies. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
mm-hmm.
where the front office people really care about public health, are quite genuine about it. You know, are very proud of the fact that they're selling bottled water and small cans of the sodas, and yet their marketing people are hard at work doing everything they can to undermine public health initiatives.
Right.
Complicated.
And that goes into sort of what you had talked about also in the book, where you talk about soda companies and their use of corporate social responsibility to sort of infiltrate areas where sodas maybe wouldn't be. So you have sodas sponsoring, you know, kids' sports teams, or sodas sponsoring school initiatives, or, you know, the American Academy of Family Physicians, or the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which both of those groups, I think, have divested from soda companies now.
They have. Yes, actually, that's very funny because Coca-Cola claims that it did the divorce first.
Mm-hmm.
And the organizations say, no, we had already decided that we were pulling out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which one of them is right. But the American Academy of Pediatrics Family Practice and Dietetics are no longer accepting money from Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm. And so it is interesting. Like, what do you think about so sodas incorporate themselves into schools, into community organizations, into major advocacy organizations, and so those people are kind of tied up, and there are certain things that they can and can't say. I worked for a local organization that I won't name, and they had a nutrition curriculum that had been, you know, paid for and sponsored by Coca-Cola. So it was just, I mean, you were reading this, I mean, it was a nutrition curriculum, and it was just hilarious how the complete absence of any mention of sodas or sugar sweetened beverages.
Yeah, they buy silent.
Right. And I think it said something like, you know, choose diet soda, but that was it. That was the only time it's mentioned in the entire thing.
In the book, I talk extensively about, I give extensive examples of groups that had intended to engage in anti-soda campaigns, mm-hmm. and then dropped those campaigns, mm-hmm. when a very generous gift suddenly arrived.
Right, and you talk about how those corporate social responsibility, that's not tied to necessarily entirely goodwill, that Coca-Cola and Pepsi, they know that their profits are going to improve when they take these types of measures, and that's why they're doing it.
Well, they wouldn't do it otherwise. They're not social service agencies.
Mm-hmm.
They're publicly traded corporations that follow the rules of publicly traded corporations. And those rules are very simple. You maximize profits to shareholders.
Right.
Everything that you do has to be aimed at maximizing profits to shareholders, or the shareholders get cross.
Right. And so what do you think about... So obviously with soda, something that we know is not nutritious, and tobacco, something we know is actively very unhealthy. You know, those corporate social responsibility with them, we can see the downsides. But what would you say about, say, for instance, I'm thinking of like a sports equipment company or a sneaker company like Converse or New Balance, you know, sponsoring sports teams. Is it different if it's a quote-unquote,
yeah,
you know,
they're
healthier?
They're not involved in public health.
But I guess, I suppose, but
that's just... There, the profit motive is explicit,
right,
and isn't covered over,
right. So they're not working against themselves, almost.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, you don't have there. It's all on this. It's all on the same side, and it's absolutely open and explicit.
Mm-hmm.
But when a food company is trying to sell a food product that is, well, I mean, it's very hard. The thing about sodas that makes them, that distinguishes them from any other food product is their calories with no nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
They're empty calories.
Right.
They have no nutritional value whatsoever. So it's completely unambiguous. I mean, that's one of the reasons for picking on them. They're an easy target.
Right.
Low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
They're the first thing you do if you want to advise somebody to lose weight. You say, stop drinking sugary drinks. It's remarkably effective.
Right.
Weight loss strategy.
Yeah.
And it's simple because it's sugars and water and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is more complicated.
Right, right. And also, I think something that you point out is that the way that soda is marketed is that, you know, we don't talk about it as being candy or a dessert, which would be two probably more appropriate ways to think about it. We think of it as you're eating a meal and it's a beverage that you have with a meal, or it's something that you have after you've worked out, which is not...
Or you have it for pleasure.
Right.
You know, whereas Center for Science and the Public Interest called it liquid candy,
mm-hmm.
You know, some years ago, more than a decade ago, and if we reframed thinking about sugary beverages as liquid candy, mm-hmm. we would have a very different attitude toward them, I think.
Yeah. So do you think that's similar, like maybe soda should take a tax sort of... I don't know if you heard about that tomato sauce company that sort of openly came out and said something like, well, you should really only... Because it had such a high sugar content, it said, well, you should really only be having this about once a week. Do you think it would be responsible for Coca-Cola to come out and say something like that?
Well, when I was in Australia and New Zealand for a couple of months this winter,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of talk about Coca-Cola there, because I was giving a lot of talks about soda politics, and mm-hmm. some reporter made a big fuss about trying to get Coca-Cola to be transparent in Australia. And the result of all the exposure of the organizations that Coca-Cola was funding in Australia was that the head of Coca-Cola Amatil, which is the Australian New Zealand corporation that sells Coca-Cola, what went on record as saying, I don't know what all the fuss is about. She said, if you have one can a week, it's not a problem.
Mm. Yeah.
And I couldn't agree with her more.
Right, right. But that's not their public message. Yeah.
It's not the public message.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Actually, I have just a quick question when I'm still here before we let you go. So, first of all, I thought it was really interesting that you brought up that originally about with the lobbying and the food stamps with soda. We've had a lot of conversations here, Friedman, in some of my classes, especially social justice-based ones, about whether or not you should be allowed to purchase soda with food stamps. And that's
a complicated issue.
Yeah, that never actually came up about how it originally got there through lobbying. So I think that people were more cognizant of that. It could have helped change the conversation.
Yeah, I was really surprised about that as well.
And I also had a quick question to wrap up is, so we were talking about Tom Brady earlier in the show, how he has some good things, like he says you shouldn't drink soda, but he also has things like you shouldn't eat tomatoes. You've posted about Warren Buffett saying that Coca-Cola is great and it's helping him live long. And then on the other hand, you have people like John Oliver, who just recently came out with a thing about how scientific studies are interpreted by the media. And do you think that we're in an era where a lot of people are just going to get their nutrition information from figures like this? And are you concerned that a lot of the legitimate science, well, two things, one, that the science is going to be lost, the real hard true science, and then the other thing is that it's going to turn more into a collection of sound bites as opposed to actually affecting lifestyles.
Well, that's our public area right now. Mm-hmm. I read in the New York Times this week that Facebook is the single most important source of news for most Americans. You know, for people like me who are dinosaurs and still read the New York Times, this is kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for those of us who are nutritionists and really care about nutrition science, we need to do something to raise the credibility of what we're doing. And one of the reasons I'm so concerned about food industry sponsorship of food and nutrition research is that I believe it destroys the credibility of that research and makes the public not trust nutritionists.
Mm-hmm.
The Global Energy Balance Network was a scandal. That was a scandal that did not make nutrition scientists look good. And so the profession has to do something about setting up criteria and ethical standards that will help restore the public trust in the kinds of statements that we're making. So at least we'll have some credibility.
Well, definitely
not
check.
Not easy.
Yes. It feeds so much into funding that's currently available for science, and the funding that's, you know, sort of in the public interest of the NIH and the, you know, the wider sort of public health sphere. But thank you so much for coming on the show today, Marion. Definitely check out the book Food Politics is your book, and Soda Politics, the newer book, and also of course your blog Food Politics.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Have a good morning.
All right, so that was our interview with Mary Nessel.
Yeah.
Very awesome
very
to have
exciting.
Her on. Very exciting. and definitely check out, again, like Catherine mentioned, her books and her blog. Stay on top of all of this, everything going on in the media.
Right,
the
and she has kind of a running list of studies that come out and who's funding them. And, you know, it's definitely a complex issue. I think at Tufts we sort of talk about this a lot, and I think there are a lot of different opinions on this issue, so it definitely makes sense to stay abreast of everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm. And that basically brings us to the end of the show.
Yes.
We will, at some point, hopefully talk about The Biggest Loser, maybe next week.
Yes,
which everyone,
The Biggest Loser. Everybody go ahead and read that article. It is on the New York Times, but
yes.
You probably also saw it on Facebook.
And you need to tune in because next week is Catherine's final show ever here.
It is my last show, so it'll just be Matt and some other co-host.
The future of the show is to be determined. We will be somewhere.
But also, if you are a Friedman student and you would like to share your Friedman experience on the air next week, that's it's the day before graduation, so we're really looking for some people who are interested in kind of talking about what their Friedman experience was like and what they've learned. And so definitely contact me or Matt if you are interested.
Definitely. You can check us out on Facebook, Unbalanced Breakfast Radio, or on SoundCloud, Unbalanced Breakfast. That does it for us. Stay tuned for Mike on the Mic, and we will be back next week. Have a good weekend.
Bye.
Soup.
Everyone adds an extra scoop.
Mix an ounce of a smile so sweet.
A dash of cool to add.